Hello and welcome back to Criterion
Close Up.
I am Mark Herney and I'm here with Aaron West. Hello again, Aaron.
Hello again.
Nice to be here. This is episode 19, and folks can hear under us Iggy Pop from the Repo Man soundtrack, a well-known soundtrack and a great song.
Good old Iggy, yeah. So. Very good song. Very good opener.
Yeah, so it seemed the most appropriate music to intro our interview episode with Mr. Alex Cox. Very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So really glad to talk to Alex. So that will be our episode today. We will have actually skipping the news, just doing the interview, and some just a couple housekeeping things at the beginning, talking about the interview and corrections at the end, a couple notes. So, and then we'll just do the interview, get right into it. Very cool stuff, Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a great time with Alex, and I think it'll come through when people listen. The interview is about an hour, 15 minutes or so, thereabouts.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was gracious to give us so much time. And frankly, we talked about so much good stuff. We could have kept going for, you know, a lot of it was just film buffs talking about film, you know, and sometimes his films, sometimes other films. And so, yeah, it was a great time.
Yeah, good stuff. And we you know, should mention, folks will notice the audio quality. We are actually surprised at how well it really does sound. Alex lives in a small house in the Oregon woods, so as you can imagine, that affected the quality a little bit, which you'll hear. But we connected the magic of technology. We're able to connect with them and record. So it really, you know, considering everything, I think it sounds great, and folks will enjoy it.
Yeah, I'd say of all shows, this was the most challenging. I mean, we've had guests with certain limitations, and but we haven't had guests that live in the Oregonian woods before. this is a first for us. And, there's not fast internet out there. There's not fast cell towers. So we had to, you know, figure something out. And we actually did. And there are some times you'll hear in the interview where Alex fades out a little bit. And then towards the end of the interview, the connection was getting a little sketchier. And actually, I think if it hadn't been for that, this probably would have been a longer interview, because we did have have our groove going. But we, you know, that ended up being a good stopping point.
Yeah, exactly. So just a note there. And mentioning, too, getting into the interview, it mostly Aaron on there. I didn't really jump in a lot. I mean, the conversation was going really well, and I didn't want to jump in, cut him off or anything. So just kind of let Alex be Alex, and it was great. He was so candid. Just loved how he really let folks know what he thought, and he was funny, super funny. So,
yeah,
and I mean, it's surprisingly funny. I mean, a lot of folks will know who Alex is, mm-hmm. but. And, like you said, I really appreciated just his film talk. It comes across that he's like us. He's a film geek.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I could tell, and if people will notice I hosted the segment. And so, you know, sometimes I bumped it to you. But, Alex had so much good stuff. And sometimes I would just throw out a film or a filmmaker, and that would get us into a digression. And you
right.
know, there's good. And so there's Kurosawa, there's Peckinpah. There's Herzog.
Yep, some Herzog on there. Kenny Rogers makes an appearance.
All sorts of things. Yeah, a lot of little topics, and of course his films too. We get into Walker, Sid and Nancy, Repo Man, of course, and we talk some about Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. So pretty much those four main ones. We probably would have got into others if it weren't for the connection towards the end, because. You know, he's worked since then, but we just wrapped it up because we weren't confident he was going to be able to stay on the line with us. So,
yeah,
but yeah,
exactly.
Sorry, I guess I could have bumped it to you more, but didn't want to break up Alex and.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was really more. Folks think of something like this as an interview. It was really more of a conversation than an interview. So, which was really great.
Definitely, definitely, and thank you, Alex.
Be some. Some mention of folks will hear too. The he has a box set on his shelf, the AK-100 there that we refer to. So that's the 25 films of Akira Kurosawa. So,
right, and
yeah,
that's one thing when you're in a discussion like this, and I tried to think well on my feet, but you can't think of everything.
Right.
And then as I was editing the show, I realized Oh, he was talking about this box set, this rare out of print box set of Kurosawa. So when we get to that point, and I'm like, I didn't have much idea what he's talking about. That's what it was. So he's a little bit of a collector like we are. So maybe not like we are, but he is a collector and cherishes things like Kurosawa, which was within arm's distance of a reaching distance of when he was doing the cast with us. So.
Exactly.
There's also a mention of Robbie Mueller, and people might not pick up on that. A lot of it we're just film geeks talking to a film geek, or film buff, maybe I should say. So Robbie Mueller is a cinematographer for Wim Wenders, and he did a lot, pretty much all of Wenders' '70s stuff, and he worked with Cox on Repo Man, but he's also done work with Jarmusch.
Yeah, Jim Jarmusch with Down by Law and a couple other films, I believe.
And also he did Paris, Texas with Wenders as well. So he's kind of been Wenders as a cinematographer. And so I did bring him up, but so just letting people know that, just for some context, if people were wondering, who are you talking about?
Right.
We know, but not everybody will know.
Yeah, so yeah, good stuff. Can't wait to hear it again. Should we get into it, Aaron?
Yeah, here we go.
Let's do it. So, and just a mention, as I mentioned before, we usually do news. We're just going to skip it. We're just going to go into the interview. So you'll hear transition music into the interview is from Joe Strummer from the Walker soundtrack. So
excellent.
This is it.
Excellent soundtrack.
Good stuff.
All right, here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Criterion Close-Up. We are here. I am Aaron West with Mark Herney, and we have special guest Alex Cox, writer, director, author, historian, aficionado, a lot of hats, Alex.
Actor,
right? and Alex, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you. We're big fans.
It is a pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise, and of course, we're big Criterion geeks, and so you have three and a half, depending on how you count, four maybe films on the collection, and we're big fans of all of them.
Really? What are they? That many?
Wow. He sounds so surprised. So I don't know if you've listened to the show, but the way we do it when we have a new guest is we get into their Criterion connections. Now, you're the first actual filmmaker we've had on the show. So, if you don't mind, we'd like to hear about your Criterion connection as a filmmaker. I'm guessing Laserdisc days.
Oh, I suppose so. That's right, because Criterion were a Laserdisc company first, weren't they? And then later they did DVDs and Blu-rays, of course.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I think Sid and Nancy was your first one, right? So, do you remember how that came about?
Well, I remember, you know what was interesting is I remember years later going to one of those websites where people who really, really care about these things compare the quality of the different editions. And they were comparing, like, the first release of Sid and Nancy with the first Criterion DVD, I think it was.
Right.
And then the version that's out on... some crappy version that's out on Fox now.
It's MGM.
Boy, I mean, you actually saw a distinct difference. And I thought, I was a bit of a Philistine. I thought, it's all going to be the same, you know. Hmm. And it actually wasn't. I mean, Criterion had actually done a much better job of the Sid and Nancy image than either the British release or the release on Fox.
That's fascinating.
Isn't it interesting? Because I mean, you can find this site. I don't have the web address to hand, but if you were to search, you can actually. They did this for a whole bunch of different of films that came out on a bunch of different companies, and they compared the editions. And certainly, in the case of Sid and Nancy, Criterion did by far the best job. So that was a very happy experience.
Unfortunately, they're out of print, but at least Sid and Nancy is out of print because of that edition, I imagine.
You know what happened with Sid and Nancy is the rights.
Yeah.
Sid and Nancy were owned by, in America, they were owned by a company called Embassy Home Entertainment. And that library was, or some of the titles of Embassy Home Entertainment were acquired by the Sam Goldwyn Company. Mm. And then they went to MGM. And MGM have just capriciously handed the DVD rights of Sid and Nancy on to Rupert Murdoch's company, Fox.
Oh.
Despicable company owned by a despicable man. and it's really embarrassing because under no circumstances would anybody who worked on Sid and Nancy have had anything to do with Murdoch at all.
Yeah.
And so for our film to not be on Criterion because the rights have passed to Murdoch is really unfortunate.
And it's a shame that you don't have a say in that, that you can't veto and say, hey, no, put it back on Criterion.
Very rarely does a filmmaker have a... I mean, I have the rights to some of my films, but not mm-hmm. to Sid and Nancy. And unfortunately, it's just been tossed around like a kind of a six-week-old hamburger. The people who are distributing it now have no clue what it is.
Well, there was a situation with the Tati titles went out of print, and the estate actually was able to somehow get them back on the Criterion. So I don't know. Maybe if you, maybe it depends on how angry you are, you can get it back.
I wouldn't think so. Even rage, I don't think. I don't think even being enraged can defeat the studios. You know, the studios are pretty powerful, and they obey no laws that I've ever heard of. So
they are, yeah. Well, of course, you have, and we'll get into the Criterion titles, but DVD, you have three titles that you directed. So were you very much involved with those?
Which are the other ones? Because you said like three and a half or four. What are the titles? Sid
well,
Nancy?
There's Repo Man, of course. Walker is...
Walker.
And Sid and Nancy, of course, which is out of print. And when I say half, it's kind of joking. You have a writing credit on Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Oh, okay. So three and a half, including the writing credit on Fear and Loathing. Got
you. So yep. if you go to the Criterion website and you search Alex Cox, you'll find four films there. So
that makes sense. Yeah, I know. That's right. I was trying to figure out what.
Depends if you count that as a half or a quarter or three quarters.
Quarter. It would be a quarter or a third or something. Probably. Well, no, it's really a half. It's pretty much.
We'll give you a half.
There's a couple of pages in there that aren't.
There. Yeah, that's what I heard. So, all right, there we go. Three and a half. Now, what about a consumer? I know, of course, there are a lot of films that you, the filmmakers that you appreciate on the collection. Are there any particular discs that you admire or that you remember purchasing? Or?
Boy, well, you know what I saw recently that I really liked was Il Sorpasso.
Oh, good one.
Mm.
I thought that was just great.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know that film at all. And I was lucky because I was teaching at CU, and so we used to just buy all these Criterion DVDs, you know, and I saw Il Sorpasso. I just thought it was a tremendous film, very surprising,
mm-hmm.
you know, that we didn't know about it, you know, that it's this tremendous, entertaining, ironic, salutary Italian film about a guy who drives too fast,
mm-hmm.
and it was great.
Yeah, great.
So I was very, very impressed by Il Sorpasso.
Fun road movie with early performance by, and I'm going to say it wrong, Trintignant?
Trintignant and Gassman.
There you
Vittorio
go.
Gassman and Jean-Luc Trintignant.
Both of Gassman especially was tremendous.
Yeah, they
do that. In fact, lately there have been a lot of Italian restorations, and they've been bringing some obscure ones. They had a Special Day come out recently, and then coming soon is I knew her well. So I didn't know you were into well. I know you're into Italian Western films. I didn't know you were into.
Well, but there's some stuff that's just so good, and you know, and it's so hard to see. You know, I mean, I wish the Criterion had the Mate Affair by Francesco Rossi. I wish they had Toby Dammit by Fellini. You know, because those are such great films, and they're kind of just like wandering around the edges of the DVD market if they're available at all.
It's tough. Yeah, Illustrious Corpuses by Rossi is one I've been longing for. So yeah, they're
Illustrious Corpses would be a great one for them to have, and Lucky Luciano. They could have a boxed set of Mate Affair, Lucky Luciano, and Illustrious Corpses.
They do have some, Rossi. They have Moment of Truth. And,
which is great.
Yeah, which is good.
And they have Salvatore Giuliano, which is incredible.
Oh, of course, yeah. Now, that one's DVD only, I believe. I'm not positive. So, yeah, and I know you're a big fan of Buñuel and Kurosawa, among others. So, Are you aware of their criterion?
Boy, they've got almost all of Kurosawa. I think they've got everything except Ran, pretty much, haven't they?
Yeah, they lost Ran. Now
again, 20th Century Fox.
I think
the devil.
Yeah. actually, was that Studio Canal? I think, yeah, it's hard to keep up, but then
Partnership.
It's a partnership. It was, I mean, to their credit, they funded the movie as well. So I mean, there's some legitimacy to them having the DVD.
Yeah, their DVD looks okay, but I think the Criterion still looks better. And then Redbeard is probably, I'm guessing that's going to come out next year because there's a new restoration of that. So that'll.
I think I've got my Criterion box of Kurosawa here. This is really kind of fanboy stuff. Let me look in my box.
Oh.
I think Redbeard's already in there.
Well, they have a DVD of Redbeard, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yes, the DVD box.
Yeah, I think they have.
Those from Sanshiro Sugata,
yeah,
up to Matadayo, and obviously there's something's missing. They don't have,
they
don't have Rand. They don't have Dreams or Rhapsody in August. But I'm not big fans of those.
Yeah, they
I'm
don't
fan of either of those.
Don't have a lot of the later films. So, but yeah, the
I don't really mind. I mean, I love Matadayo, and they have Matadayo, and I love Rand.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
That's one they still have on Hulu too, Matadayo. But the others they don't have any releases of.
Almost nobody's seen Matadayo too. I mean, it didn't get good reviews, and it hasn't. I mean, it's very rare that you see anybody who's seen it. But
yeah, I confess,
I enjoyed it.
I haven't seen it, so
it's really interesting.
Yeah,
it's about an old guy. It's about a really old guy who's revered by everybody, you know, and he has all these acolytes who keep coming to see him and bowing and scraping and telling him he's the greatest thing on earth, and they all get drunk. And, you know, and he thinks of himself as just a fool, you know.
He's
a fool, and his cat runs away, and he loses it completely. When his cat runs away, he just becomes like a vegetable. And, you know, and obviously, of course, I was talking about himself. He's making a film about himself.
Yeah.
He's sort of the old, superannuated, but hugely revered hero, you know. So it's a very interesting film and really worth seeing.
They just came out with a Kiru upgrade, which sounds pretty similar to that. So that's a favorite of mine.
Oh, well, the Kiru is the... Yeah. That's the greatest of his social dramas.
And for those who don't know, you did a documentary on Kurosawa. Is that correct? TV documentary?
I did a documentary on Kurosawa, which somebody has luckily... So if you root around, you can find a documentary that I made called Kurosawa, The Last Emperor.
Right. Yeah.
And it's got interviews with a bunch of film directors who admired his work, like Francis Coppola and Paul Verhoeven, John Woo, Mike Hodges, Bertolucci. But it's also got interviews with his collaborators, with Terio Nogami. She was his constant producer.
Wow.
His producer, Masato Hara. His granddaughter, Kazuko, who was his costume designer on his last couple of films. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if it's available. I did look for it. I couldn't find it.
It's not really available, but somebody has posted it on YouTube. So if you root around the internet, you can find it. I think it's not available because we don't have actually the rights to it. We had the rights to screen it for a couple of years on ILC and to screen it on Channel 4 in the UK. Mm-hmm. But I don't think. But we never had the rights to put it online or to stream it. But luckily, there are those who don't care about these things. Anyway.
Yeah, there are a lot of those. Well, maybe we could just blame Rupert Murdoch for that one, too. So
it's his fault.
Why not?
Yeah.
Well, and of course, Alex, you have a project you're working on now, Tombstone Rashomon, which I think ties pretty well to the collection and to all these art films, actually many that aren't in the collection. And I've been following along. You did an Indiegogo campaign, which I am a proud backer.
Oh. Yes, we did an Indiegogo campaign, and we raised like a seventh of our budget, you know, which we thought we were going to get $200,000 and like $30,000.
Yeah.
But, you know, we got to make the film, haven't we? Otherwise, we have to give the money back. So we're going to go make it anyway.
Good. You just finished the second draft of the script, and I saw you had some notes from people, which is great.
And more coming. I'm supposed to get Frank Cottrell Boyce, who wrote Revenge's Tragedy, the screenplay, and a bunch of other stuff. Frank is going to give me notes, and anybody who's read the script is welcome to give me notes.
Yeah, I skimmed it. I'm one of these kind of people that doesn't like reading scripts just because I want to have some sort of element of surprise when I see the feature. But I would not.
I agree. I mean, if I was a backer of it, I wouldn't read the script either. I would just wait until the film was finished.
But I'm not going to be.
But I think part of what's interesting about crowdfunding is that you actually, as a backer, you get to participate in the process. So if you want to read the script, you can.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And if you want to see, you know, how the auditions are going, you can. You know, so it's a kind of interesting.
So little guys like us can boss around Alex Cox. Or
well, I mean, the thing is, it's great because nobody can really boss me around because there's enough money. You know, it's
right.
A miracle if we manage to make it at all. So that's really great freedom.
Well, we're rooting for it.
But seriously, I mean, I think anybody. I mean, it's the good thing is, or the bad thing is, that we have like some 270 backers or something like that. That's a comparatively small number because we had like almost 2,000, I think, on Build a Galactic Hero. So,
right, yeah,
it's much easier to communicate with the backer ape. You know,
it has been, yeah. And is there any way of course, Mark actually when he wanted to contribute, but it was closed. Of course, is there any way people
still can? Let me just send me a check.
Perfect.
All right, there
because
we go.
I'll just treat it the same way. It'll just go into the same fund.
All right, yeah.
And it will all be spent on the production of Tombstone. So I forget what the award levels were. But suppose you wanted to be the executive producer of the film, you could still send me a check for $20,000.
That's the level I was at.
For example.
You know, I'm willing to bet you people are going to ask and want to contribute now after they hear this. So, in fact, I hope so. Well, let me ask you, of course, with the collection we have just this year, Ford's My Darling Clementine came out. Yeah, beautiful film. And then, of course, Rashomon. But really, I think the Earp myth is... you know, there's Gunfight at the OK Corral. There's, of course, Tombstone. There's the Wyatt Earp movie from the 90s. But of course, the myth is sort of there's always questions about the myth. And now, is that kind of the approach you're taking with the Rashomon? Are you, you know, trying to look at?
Because it's different people telling the story, and some of the people are, you know, one of the guys who tells his story is a guy whose brother was shot that day, so. And another guy telling his story is the guy who was the town sheriff who was trying to disarm the cowboys when the Earps showed up. So there are definitely different takes, and there's definitely some of the testimony is an anti-Earp testimony.
Hmm.
So it depends who you're listening to. When you see the Wyatt Earp section or the Doc Holliday section, it's going to be on the side of the Earps and Doc Holliday. But when you get to the Johnny Bean section or the Ike Clanton section or the Kate Haroni section, you know, they're talking from their point of view, which isn't necessarily in favor of the Earps, but isn't necessarily truthful either.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
That's what Phil Tippett said about the script and about the interview structure, is that he liked the interview structure because they're all crooks and liars. And they're all just saying stuff to promote their angle.
Mm-hmm. And really, all the other adaptations have been from the, you know, Earp is the hero, and Holliday, sort of the hero, more of an anti-hero, maybe.
A very romantic character, yes.
Extremely, yes. Yeah. So you're looking to find a middle ground there.
Well, not really, no. I'm looking for all the extremes. I don't know what the middle... I don't think the middle ground is never very interesting. It's always, the extremes are always more interesting.
Oh, yeah, good point. And I think you've actually, through your career, you've explored the extremes very well, I should say.
Yeah, and there is one movie that's very anti-Earp. I mean, there's a movie called Doc.
I'm sorry.
With Stacey Keach and Faye Dunaway.
You broke up there for a second. What was the title?
There's a movie called Doc.
Dark.
Which stars Stacey Keach and Faye Dunaway. And that totally revisionist view of the thing from the late 70s or 80s, where Doc Holliday is a witness to Wyatt Earp's ambitious campaign to become sheriff or senator or president or who knows what, because Earp is portrayed as a really sadistic megalomaniac, you know, and so it's an interesting film, and it has a completely different perspective, obviously, from Tombstone or from My Darling Clementine.
Mm. I'll have to seek that out. I have not seen that or even heard about it, actually.
Really worth watching.
Yeah, hopefully it's
a decent film, directed by Frank Perry.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. I hope, assuming they're the rights, somebody has them in the States, but...
They do. I actually sent the DVD to one of the guys that's working on the film, but I had the DVD.
Oh, great. Okay. I'll seek that out. And just curious if you, when you get this project, is there sort of are you going for a spaghetti western vibe or an acid Monty Hellman sort of vibe or a Kurosawa vibe?
Really none of those, because it's
a Peckinpah, maybe.
It's sort of a parody of the bogus Errol Morris, kind of have the guy put the guy in front of a gray background and have him talk down the barrel of the camera.
Oh, okay.
So it's a sort of a parody of Errol Morris's documentary style, interspersed with flashbacks. So we have, you know, Wyatt Earp or whoever it is telling their version of these events, and then we go into those events from their perspective.
That sounds fascinating, actually.
Yeah.
Are you going to have a tape recorder at the end?
And right now there's five, but there might be a sixth one, because some people asked me to, that they thought that, because Doc Holliday is so famous.
Right.
And it is, and generally in the movies, you know, it's whether it's Val Kilmer or Victor Mature. I mean, he's like the most interesting character.
Oh yeah, always. You know? Yeah, that's the meatiest part.
Yeah, and so really, I have to do a Doc Holliday interview as well, which I haven't done yet. So, and that means going, because I've been using the testimony at the inquest and at the court hearing, where Wyatt Earp and Johnny Behan and Ike Clanton. All gave testimony, and Doc Holliday didn't speak at the hearing, and so I have to go elsewhere to try and find his voice. But there's newspaper interviews that were done with him.
So you're doing a lot of research then? You're not going...
It's all research based. Yeah, I've got my little bookshelf here, and it's got, you know, Turf Tiller, Wyatt Earp, The Last Gunfight, Jeff Gwynn, Frank Waters' book, The Earp Brothers of Tombstone, which is great. Wyatt Earp by Andrew Eisenberg. Murdered on the Streets of Tombstone by Joyce Arros. Inventing Wyatt Earp by Alan Barra. And Die in the West by Paula Marx. Robert's book, Doc Holliday. Tombstone, Iliad by Walter Noble Burns. Wyatt Earp Speaks by Richard Stevens. And then the transcript of the OK Corral inquest.
Well, I can't wait.
Those are my resources.
And if any listeners want to write a check to Alex for $25,000, actually,
or 20, or 50, or 5, or whatever you feel like.
We'll have people get in touch with the show, and we can relay that information. Does that work for you, Alex?
Absolutely. No, I think that's a great idea. Because we obviously we're not going to shoot until May of next year, middle of May. So we have time, and all contributions gratefully received. And I still haven't given away my Repo Man T-shirt. The only T-shirts that went when we were doing the backers rewards for the Indiegogo campaign. The only T-shirts that went were Walker and Sid and Nancy.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I would have thought Repo Man would be the first to go, but Repo Man didn't get a snack gun.
Sure.
Well, on that note, do you mind delving into some of your other works?
No, absolutely.
Well, we figured we'd go in order of spy numbers to talk about some of these. And I don't know if you're too familiar with the spy number process, but I think it's a pretty good natural progression.
Go for it.
Well, of course, the first one is spy number 20, and that's Sid and Nancy, or Love Kills. And as you mentioned, great edition, out of print currently.
It was a really nice, I think they made a very nice package of it. It really was the nicest edition of Sid and Nancy that ever came out.
And that was really early, too. And do you acknowledge being, you know, on the same label as Buñuel and Kurosawa? Does that mean much to you? Do you feel canonized?
And Michael Bay.
I think everybody's trying to forget about that one.
It's all arbitrary, isn't it?
It's all arbitrary. Yeah.
But it's great. It's great to be juxtaposed with any great artist, or put in the vicinity of any great artist. It's fantastic, of course.
And I mentioned Monty Hellman. I mean, it really is all over the map.
And Monty Hellman.
Absolutely. So now, of course, Sid and Nancy is quite a story. I believe you Well, of course, it's the UK punk scene. Were you a fan of the punk scene in the 70s? I think you lived in LA, didn't you?
I moved to Los Angeles in 1977, so I really knew the punk scene there. I was more familiar with the sort of the West Coast hardcore scene.
Okay.
And so I knew all of those bands like Circle Jerks and Suicidal Tendencies and The X and The Fears and all these other bands. Well, of course, The Clash came and Devo and you know, Talking Heads. And so it was quite a fervent time.
So The Damned, Buzzcocks, any of those? Or were you more...
No, he said I wasn't so into the British scene because I was into the Sex Pistols and The Clash. I loved The Clash. Gang of Four. Gang of Four.
Me too. Yeah. Wire?
Yeah. No, never really got into Wire. Later on, I got into the Pogues, a little bit after the punk thing, but that was because I was working for them, you know, and so...
Yeah, they went to Nicaragua with you.
So they went to Nicaragua, but before that, I'd done a video for them, and they'd been in... actually, only one of them went to Nicaragua, that was Spider Stacy, but they all went to Spain. They all went to Spain to do Straight to Hell.
A friend of mine lost her hearing at a Pogues show, so
it can be done.
It can. I wouldn't peg the Pogues. I would think maybe the West Coast punk scene might be more likely. But that's interesting that you you're a West Coast fan,
And actually, funnily enough, it did do one of my ears in because we used to go to the Starwood and we'd always stand on the right hand side of the auditorium, and so I do have like one of my. I'm going deaf in both ears, but it's severely advanced in the ear that used to be by the speakers.
Oh, is that?
And I have a friend, Dambert No Bacon, who was in Chumbawamba.
Okay.
Hearing aids.
Yeah.
<You know>? Dambert looks like he's 35. You know, he's older than that, but he's like 2 hearing aids.
Yeah, a lot of them get
the noise levels.
Tinnitus and it's all that exposure. And I think people back then didn't care, especially in the punk scene, didn't care at all.
Oh yeah, who cares? Who'd have it any other way? I don't think either Dambert or I would want it to be any different.
Right? Can you imagine Johnny Rotten saying, "Oh my blessed ears"?
Yeah.
or Sid Vicious. Yeah. So, were you? Did you say one? Yeah, of course. This is after Repo Man. Did you say? Oh, I'd love to make a UK punk movie about the Sex Pistols, or did it just kind of happen?
No, I wasn't really so much into the Sex Pistols. I was more into the Clash.
Yeah, right.
But what was interesting was the Sid and Nancy thing. It was a Sid and Nancy love affair, and so the poor Sex Pistols were just like the backdrop to that. So it's not a good film about the Sex Pistols. I think that Julian Temple's films about the Sex Pistols, The Filth and the Fury, and The... Those are the ones to see.
The Swindle, yeah.
For a good taste of the Sex Pistols phenomenon.
Yeah, and he worked on My Way, didn't he?
He directed the original My Way. Okay. That was his idea. I mean, we just amped it up, you know. I mean, he had a little staircase and a little gun, you know. So we had a great big staircase and we had a great big gun, but it was all based on his original choreography and you know, mise-en-scene.
Brilliant scene. Mark, I know you own the Out of Print DVD. Is that correct, Mark?
I do. I have it sitting here in front of me. It's the early spine number 20, kind of has the old logo that comes up with the 2 C's when you watch it.
So, Alex, if I could ask you, of course, you know, we like to tie things here to Criterion, and and I know the choices of the lead actors, you've probably been asked this a million times, I apologize. But I know that you auditioned Daniel Day-Lewis and Gary Oldman, and I think it's interesting because, of course, Lewis had just come off two really polar opposites as far as range goes with Laundrette and A Room with a View, which both came out Criterion earlier this year.
I don't think he had done either of those when we auditioned for Tim Nancy. I don't think he or Gary had done.
Oh, really? You know, that was 85. Both were... he did Room...
Tim and Nancy was shot in 85, yes.
It might have been right around the same time. Interesting. Okay, I didn't know that.
Maybe he made them immediately afterwards. That's possible.
So,
but because I think... I'm sure that they made My Beautiful Laundrette afterwards. Because we might even have talked about that at the interview. We might even have talked about how he was going to go and work with Stephen Frears.
Now, of course, did when you talked to him, could you see him in a punk? I mean, of course, he does not have a punk background or a lower class background.
Well, this was the thing, because he was at the time just beginning his acting career,
right?
And he hadn't done a lot of acting. He was also the son of the poet laureate of England,
mm-hmm.
Cecil Day Lewis. So he came from an aristocratic and very privileged background. And Gary Oldman was the son of working-class parents from Bermondsey in London, where Sid Vicious grew up. Mm-hmm. So in a completely classist way, I guess, I just thought, go for Gary Oldman, man. Because,
well,
you know, that was he knew whereof what he spoke. And I didn't have the imagination to see that son of the poet laureate
mm-hmm.
from a very upper-class background could also put himself in that position.
Right, and it worked out. I mean, Gary Oldman was fantastic, and of course...
Gary Oldman was just perfect in it. He's just perfect, and Dan Lewis had a great career, but actually, he wasn't a great actor at the beginning.
You didn't like
his performances in My Beautiful Laundrette. Are that interesting?
You didn't like him in Laundrette?
Hmm?
You didn't like him in...
I don't find the film very... No, I don't find
really?
The film very interesting.
I enjoy it because
but,
of the Thatcher...
I mean, it was a decent film. And his intentions were good, but I didn't think it was a... No, I don't think the acting was particularly marvelous.
Hmm. That's interesting, yeah. And of course, A Room with a View was probably not your speed.
Oh, that kind of pop stuff, yeah. But, you know, as people go along, they get better
mm-hmm.
as actors. Sometimes. And he did.
Oh,
he's
sure.
become an outstanding actor.
Well, he's the method, probably like the preeminent method actor today. Almost, you know, I heard he never broke Lincoln character when he did Lincoln. But of course, Gary Oldman is phenomenal.
I mean, they're both very, very good actors. And the thing was, and Dan Lewis got better as he went along. He got better and better. So I think, in a way, it was better to have cast Gary because Gary was just there. He got it. I mean, he was so talented, both as an actor, but also as a mimic.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about his performance as Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right, yeah.
How he replicates the weird kind of accent of Lee Harvey Oswald and how Oswald gets things wrong sometimes when he speaks. Says axed instead of asked.
Mm-hmm. Dracula, he was a good Dracula, and
he was just. I thought that was kind of because I'd seen him do that in the pub.
Oh,
the ghosties. You would all sit around going, "That reminds me of the broken battlements of my castle in you know, we would just sit around doing that for a joke. So then to see him in those great costumes. Still imitating Bela Lugosi. I thought he should have gone beyond that.
He did chew scenery a little bit, but I thought it worked. I wasn't crazy about the movie, but I found everything, even Tinker Tailor, I think.
No, he's the costumes. I thought the costumes were smashing in Dracula.
Well, of course, in Nancy, you worked with also another early in his career phenom, Roger Deakins.
Oh, yes. That's the second film that Roger shot, I think.
He'd
shot... I think 1984 before.
Yeah, right, and that's a pretty big start to his career. And of course, I know, and we'll talk about Robbie Mueller in a little bit. But how do you think the two of them compare as far as their techniques?
That's an interesting question. Robbie wasn't very keen on handheld photography when I worked with him. He was more interested in trying to find like a kind of a perfect two shot and get it off the sticks. Roger was a bit more up for, and Robbie wasn't opposed to the zoom.
Mm-hmm.
Roger was very anti the zoom, wasn't afraid of handheld photography,
mm-hmm.
which is great because I love handheld photography. So that was great. I was fixated on a certain lens choices. He only wanted to use two lenses, so I think almost the whole film was shot with a 35mm and an 85mm. So they both had very specific ways of working.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember both of them, both Robbie and Roger, telling me, you know, there's only one good shot. No point in shooting multiple cameras. because there's only one good shot. You just set it up and you get the good shot.
That's interesting.
And that was what we did. We never had it. Was there anything? And then, of course, you think about Robbie with 24-hour party people and Roger doing big studio pictures, you know, like 13 days and stuff, and shooting 20 cameras, you know. So it's funny that in a sense, both of them had this very old school, very specific take on cinematography, which then later they abandoned.
Yeah, I would say.
And that's right, too, because you shouldn't get caught in, you shouldn't get caught in any one style. You should be open to change.
And I really think the photography in Sid and Nancy is
beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's beautiful, but it's not like, you know, Deakin's later work where it's kind of draws attention to itself. I think it's, I don't want to use the term washed out because it's not, but it's understated. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, neither Robbie's nor Roger's work draws attention to it.
Yeah. Now, I'm a big Wenders fan, so I actually love Mueller's work in the 70s.
American Friend.
And that's actually coming out on Criterion. Is that, Mark, is that January, February?
Yeah, I think it's January.
Yeah, I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're touring all of Wenders' movies. I think we're going to get them all with beautiful.
That's great. So we'll get Kings of the Road as well, because that hasn't been available in a long time. So
that's a beautiful movie, yes. And people haven't seen it. Now, do you keep up with home media much? Do you buy new discs as they come out, or are you more?
Well, I'll get American Friend.
Very good.
I'll definitely get American Friend because I love that film.
It's a great film. Yeah, we're actually going to do a podcast with that, and Purple Moon is the double feature, so we're going to do a twofer with Ripley. So that'll be fun.
Excellent.
And of course, Sid and Nancy. It's interesting that the Pistols music, well, unofficially the Pistols music wasn't used, and Joe Strummer, we mentioned The Clash, who I think Joe Strummer is just a phenomenal musician. And was this the beginning of your relationship with him?
Sid and Nancy, yes, but the Sex Pistols stuff on Sid and Nancy was all orchestrated by Glenn Matlock,
right,
who had been one of the Sex Pistols and was replaced by Sid. And so ironically, all the scenes where Gary Oldman's playing the bass guitar, that's Glenn Matlock.
Mm. Really, yeah.
Okay. Sid Fisher.
And what's ironic is Glenn could play.
he could really play, but he wasn't as cool looking as Sid.
Right.
Well, wasn't that great? And I think we tried to make that clear in the movie that Sid was really there. He was just a stooge, but he looked so good, you know.
Oh yeah. He was punk rock.
Yeah.
So, and of course, you've probably been asked about the accuracy a gazillion times, and I won't even get into Johnny Rotten. We'll just put him in the.
Oh, he was great. I mean, he was really nice and really kind and helpful to us before we began. And he made friends with Drew Schofield, who played him in the film.
Right. He was against it afterward, and has he come around since?
Oh, I think he didn't like it, but that was under. He didn't like it beforehand either. He thought we should have made it much different.
Really?
He said there's no point in trying to replicate the Sex Pistols and me and stuff because you won't get it quite right, and you'd be better off really fictionalizing it and having it be a band like the Sex Pistols. So he said, you know, like Drew Schofield, who's going to play me,
right,
but who comes from Liverpool. Well, he should be from Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have your Johnny Rotten character be a Scouser from Liverpool. And the funny thing was, at the time, I had this idea of asking Sandra Bernhardt to play Sid.
I heard about that. My mind was blown. You are talking about the female Sandra Bernhardt,
yes.
Correct? I mean,
yes.
I can see it.
But she should play Sid. And so if I had only just gone in the direction that John Lydon suggested, that would have been interesting.
The shirtless scenes might have been a little...
Which ones?
A little different.
The shirtless scenes.
Great. They'd have been great.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, that might... I would have enjoyed
it. So. No, it would be great. much rather look at Sandra Bernhardt. No disrespect to any to Gary or Dan Lewis.
Sure, yeah. No.
But anyway, that didn't come about. But that was Johnny Lydon's idea, and it was a good one. Or at least the idea that we should fictionalize the band and not be so literal.
Kind of like Todd Haynes' Velvet Goldmine, kind of in that sense. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Is that what?
No. I don't know.
Oh, that's a film where he pretty much did Bowie and Jagger, but he didn't do Bowie and Jagger. He made fictionalized versions of them, and they're very obvious if you watch it.
Yeah, I was thinking of The Rose, too.
Yeah, The Rose, Janis. Yeah, that's a good example.
Yeah, exactly. But so you don't make it entire exactly. I mean, we could even have called him Sid and Nancy, but just call him, you know, him.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Just fake the other stuff and deliberately make it different, which we do really with the punk scene anyway, because the London punk scene wasn't the hardcore mosh pit scene.
You know, right. Right.
You know, it was a bunch of individual skinny guys jumping up and down doing the pogo, which was different. But I was used to the mosh pit scene, and it's so dramatic looking. It was so exciting.
Yeah, I'm actually a child of the 80s, and I am as well, or a teenager of the 80s. So I'm.
Yay!
I was right there with you. Repo Man, well, we'll get to that. All right, well, let's move on to Walker, if you don't mind. Familiar with it?
I remember it. What number is that?
423. 423.
Excellent.
What's funny is Mark and I were talking about it the other. I just watched it for the first time actually this week. I loved it, and I love Joe Strummer. That's one of my favorite scores. I just saw it.
That's a wonderful score.
It's not like it at all, but made me think about Knopfler and Local Hero. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but.
Local Hero was a film by Bill Douglas.
Was it Forsyth?
Bill Forsyth. I never saw it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's good. But of course, Strummer and Knopfler, not too similar. But Strummer, I think, is a remarkable musician. But Mark, we were talking
about.
I don't like to do the meets so and so meets so and so film, but we kind of did that this week. What did we say, Mark?
I'm trying to remember. I know Jodorowsky came to mind a little bit for me, but I'm trying to remember who we said.
Peckinpah, I thought of Pat Garrity, and I thought of Aguirre, Wrath of God. And now, of course, you know, we're just people watching films, you know, 30 years later. Does that sound like it fits?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's definitely in. Well, I mean, Pat Garrett is by Rudy. You know, the script is by Rudy Wurlitzer. Who wrote Walker, you know, I mean, Pat Gap is the most political Western ever. Because it takes you into the house of the governor of the state of New Mexico, Lew Wallace, you know, and they're talking about how they got to get rid of these bums, you know. I know it's a bit of a problem, but we have to get, you know, clean things up for election time, you know. And the interaction between the people at the lowest level of society who are always getting killed in these gunfights, you know, and the powers that be, like Chisholm and Lew Wallace, whose feet rarely touch the ground, you know, and how Pat Garrett is trying to move into that stratum of society, you know, and be untouchable, and of course doesn't succeed, you know. It's a very good film. So Walker's definitely in the, and that was why I thought Rudy would be such a good writer for it, was because of Pat Garrett. Although I enjoyed Two Men Backed Up as well, but I thought that I can't believe the kid is a masterpiece. You know, not only of the director, but of the writer.
I agree. No, and unsung masterpiece. I think it's, you know, in the last 10, 20 years, it's really gotten its due, but still not actually. Is that on physical media, Mark?
I think it's. I know there's a DVD set out there, but I think we need to petition Criterion to put that one out.
They should. I mean, there's three versions of Pat Garrett. There's the original studio version, which was just cut down, and they got rid of the beginning and the ending, and didn't make any sense. There's a version that Roger Spottiswoode, the editor, and Dennis Dolan, the editor of Repo Man, smuggled out of the studio when Peckinpah was fired in Dennis's Volkswagen. And they kept that for like 20 years. And then that was the official version of the film. But it's kind of overlong. And then Roger Spottiswoode went back in and re-edited it and made a kind of a shorter version of the long version. And that's like really good.
Yeah, I saw it came on TCM a few months back, but I wasn't sure which cut. But that's.
I imagine they'd be showing the most recent Spottiswoode version.
Probably, yeah. That's
because he was the editor. He was the editor in charge, and he knew he had an idea. Both, I mean, the middle version is the kind of is where they'd left it when Peckinpah got fired, and the final version is where Roger thinks they would have taken it.
Interesting.
As I understand it.
Yeah, that's one thing that Criterion does pretty well is if there are multiple versions, they'll put them all out. So
that's great. Yeah, they should.
Of course, some listeners are probably going to tweet us or email us that it's never going to happen, but we'd love it if it happened. Now, and of great. Course, Aguirre, Wrath of God, of course, without...
And Aguirre, yeah, I mean, and Walker is in the shadow of Aguirre because Aguirre is a great film about imperialist adventures in Latin America.
Yeah, you just didn't have to work with Klaus Kinski.
I would love to have worked with Kinski.
Really?
Yeah. I thought he was marvelous.
Oh, he's a tremendous actor.
Because don't forget that even though Klaus Kinski, you know, got this bad reputation, mm-hmm. and a lot of it was due to Werner Herzog bad-mouthing him and making that movie about him.
Burden of Dreams,
but
right.
Herzog was the crazy one, not Kinski. When Mick Jagger and Jason Robards quit Fitzcarraldo and refused to return to the Amazon and refused to work with Herzog anymore, mm-hmm. who saved his ass by stepping in and taking over the lead role?
Kinski, yeah, right.
Yeah?
Yeah, of course.
So Kinski was the loyalist of mm-hmm. actors.
In fact, they shot the Jagger scenes. I just didn't think they worked, the ones that exist. So no, Kinski. Fitzcarraldo would not be Fitzcarraldo without Kinski, and Aguirre would not be Aguirre without.
No, Kinski was the loyalist of actors, and when other actors bailed on Herzog mm-hmm. because he was too demanding and too crazy, Kinski was the one who stepped into the flame and saved the day. So Kinski is like a hero for me.
Everybody, Werner Herzog, crazy. You heard it here.
Kinski, okay.
Well, actors, you worked with lots of actors. So
I love actors. Actors are great.
I've met a bunch, too. I used to live in North Hollywood, so interesting people.
Oh, you've seen some actors in their natural habitat.
Yeah, you encounter them at dinner, but you learn not to bother them.
You shouldn't approach them. No, you shouldn't approach them because they can charge.
Yeah, well, this was about 15 years ago, so I... But again, so Walker, I think, is this your favorite film that you've made?
I think probably the best film I've made is Highway Patrolman.
Okay, I haven't seen that.
In terms of just filmmaking, Highway Patrolman is entirely Masters. There's a couple of scenes in Walker which are like moving Masters, like the fight in the when Walker plays the piano. And there's another scene later which is also a long Master. But after Walker, I started making films that were like entirely in moving Masters. And Highway Patrolman is the first of those, and that's probably the best film I've done.
Really?
And Walker is the next best.
I'm sorry I haven't seen it. I have to seek that out. Is that available?
Well, that is definitely available for Criterion because the previous distributor went bankrupt.
Uh-huh. All right, Criterion.
But I think it probably drove the previous distributor into bankruptcy, so Criterion can step in and take up the... The banner. It's a very good film. I mean, not many people have seen it because it's in Spanish. It was shot in Mexico. There's no American actors in it.
Alan Brista. That's.
It's about corruption in the Mexican Highway Patrol.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good subject. I'm actually just pulled it up, and it looks like it has a good reputation. But you're right. It looks like it's not as widely seen. Of course, in these days, there's, you know, upgrades, new restorations. Do you think there's any chance of Walker getting a upgrade, or do you control this one?
No, Walker belongs to Universal, which is why we're really lucky that Criterion got a hold of it, because
right.
Universal suppressed the film for many, many years, and I had, when we get onto Repo Man, this will all fold into itself, because I had done Universal a favor by making all of these DVD elements for them, for Repo Man. And I said, in return, I would like you guys to bring out Walker on DVD as well, which they refused to do. And then, lo and behold, Universal got in touch with Criterion and said, we don't want anything to do with this. Do you want it?
Wow.
And so Criterion picked it up, like as a favor to Universal. Isn't that funny? So, and of course, from my point of view, it's much better because the additional elements of the piece on a Criterion disc are normally much better than they would be on a studio disc.
Yeah, I love you going through the reviews.
Yes.
That's a great piece.
You had to enjoy that.
Yes.
And threw him in, well, I'm not going to spoil the... well,
throw him in the fire. Throw him in the wood stove.
Well, Walker is in print, and actually, I don't own it, so that's one I'm going to buy right away. I guess, are you aware of any plans to upgrade it?
Well, you know what they should do is they should make a Blu-ray, shouldn't they? Criterion, are you listening? Blu-ray of Walker. And that would be nice.
And Straight to Hell, and maybe a few others while we're at it.
Well, we don't want to go too crazy with it because they've got a lot of directors on their roster. But if they were going to bring out another film of mine, they should bring out Harry Patrolman, probably.
Okay, well...
Because it is... But you know what I think they should do as well, while they're at it? They should bring out a whole kind of subculture thing of popular Mexican cinema, modern popular Mexican cinema. Not like Alfonso Cuarón and right. Water for Chocolate, but like the kind of films that are playing now in Mexico about the narcotraficantes and about political corruption and people caught in that world. There's some fantastic comedies and thrillers that we never see. You know, they could do a whole subtext, modern Mexican narco comedies or narco thrillers, and Harry Patrolman would fold into that anyway.
Yeah, it's well, it's not Mexican. It's of course it's American, but I think of Che when you said that. But of course that's Soderbergh, right? Yeah, actually,
the movie about Che Guevara. But that's a big American studio picture and it's also the usual thing. What they got Benicio del Toro, who's Puerto Ricanio, pretending to be an Argentinian because they couldn't find an Argentinian actor. You know, but it's always like that. I do not understand why an American movie, when they have somebody play a Mexican, the person's always played by a Puerto Ricanio or a Spaniard or a Pole, you know? I mean,
I think they think, and they're probably right in a lot of cases that a lot of Americans can't tell the difference or don't care, you know?
Well, no, that would be true, yeah, but even so, Mexican actors, there's so many good Mexican actors, is the thing. Yeah, and you don't really need to bring Benicio del Toro to Mexico because you've got, 200 Mexican actors better than him waiting to work. So it's interesting how hard it is to sort of get authentically into a national culture in terms of cinema, because we've got all these expectations. And I had a friend who was working on a project, an American project in Mexico City, and the production coordinator got kidnapped. It was an American production, and this guy got kidnapped for ransom. And so the whole deal was, don't tell the Americans. And the thing was, the Americans never realized. They would come in, but they would just come into the office and they'd just see a bunch of smiling Mexicans. How you doing? You know, and out they go again. They don't know what anybody does. They don't know what anybody's name is. And, you know, so they don't know the production coordinator's been kidnapped, you know, with all the, you know, with the production computer and all the social security numbers and bank account information of everybody in the production, you know. and they just kept it a secret and until the guy's family ransomed him and they got him back.
Wow.
And the Americans never knew, the studio never knew this had gone on.
So that's the kind of story Criterion can tell. But I'm trying to think of Mexican films. Of course, Guillermo del Toro, they've done a couple. And of course, Cuarón, I forget how you pronounce it. They did Tu Mamá También. You probably can't get
it. Well, see, a lot of the sort of, there was a generation of filmmakers that included Cuarón and Guillermo del Toro, who were kind of used making a couple of Mexican films as a stepping stone to become American directors.
Oh, sure.
But there's also a whole class of guys that haven't done that, that have, stayed in Mexico and are continuing to make films for the domestic market, which don't get seen. Luis Estrada.
South America.
Arturo Ripstein, you know, whose films just don't get seen at all.
They actually just put out their first South American film this year, La Cienega, Lucretia Martel.
I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's worth it, yeah. So,
what's that from?
It's Argentina.
I saw another good Argentinian film, Cuentos Salvajes. Did you see that? Wild Tales.
Oh, yeah, I have seen that. With the airplane. Yeah.
Different
level.
Entertaining films about rage, but it was good.
Very, very rage. I think early aughts, I'm Not Scared, I think, was that Mexican? I forget. We could talk about random films forever. All right, well, let's...
Anyway, that's what Criterion should do next, is they should bring out a really super fantastic, you know, like with the sort of, you know, Japanese Yakuza. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They could do a similar little sub...
Well, Arrow Films.
...subframe of modern Latin American narco cinema.
Arrow Films are putting up out a lot of those right now. That's kind of been their thing. And of course, they're doing the Spaghetti Westerns, too. Day of Anger, Cemetery Without Crosses, a couple others.
That's a very good-looking film, Cemetery Without Crosses, and very little dialogue, almost no dialogue.
Yeah, they're doing great work right now in Arrow. Yeah. Of course, the Arrow is a UK, but they have US as well. All right, well, if you don't mind, let's move on to Repo Man. I don't want to keep you forever. Of course, would you consider this your... The enduring film, the most, I don't want to say popular, but the most lasting?
Oh, I think that's the film that I've made that is the most popular.
Yeah. And
all the films I've made, yeah.
And obviously, it's not your favorite, but does it...
Well, I like it well enough. I like it very much, but it's, I mean, I like it, but it wouldn't be my favorite. Not of all the things I've done, if I was going to pick a favorite, but I like Repo Man. Repo Man's good.
So I heard a story that Repo Man wouldn't have existed if not for Kenny Rogers. Is that true?
It's true, because this guy, who was Kenny Rogers' manager, was trying to sign up Michael Nesmith.
Of the Monkees?
One of his clients. Of the Monkees. And Michael, at that point, was dabbling in film production. He produced one movie called Time Rider, and he'd signed on as executive producer of Repo Man. And tried to take it around various studios, got nowhere. And so he was in this bar called Morton's in Los Angeles. It was right after came out. And so all the studio executives were there, and they were dressed in cowboy-themed jumpsuits. Can you imagine? And Kenny Rogers' manager, who I presume is wearing a cowboy hat and a buckskin jacket and all that, you know, is sitting at a table with Nesmith. And so he says, "So what are you doing, Michael? What are you doing nowadays?" And Michael says, "Well, I'm trying to produce this movie, but I haven't really been able to get it on." And the manager goes, "Who do you take it to?" And he goes, "Oh, I took it to Universal." And the manager goes, "There's Bob Ring, head of Universal, standing over at the bar there in the cowboy-themed jumpsuit." "Raimi, get over here!" You know, and so he calls the guy up, and Raimi comes running over, because of course these guys are always in terror, you know. Mm-hmm. And the guy says, "Well, Bob, why are you making Michael's film?" And Raimi goes, What? What film?" And he goes, "Michael's got this great movie, haven't you, Michael? What's it called?" And Michael goes, "Repo Man." And the agent goes, "Well, why aren't you making this movie? It sounds like a great movie to me." Doesn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And Raimi goes, "Oh, well, I guess we are."
And of course,
just a light goes on in the room, you know, over all their heads, like the light bulb shines, and Repo Man is green lit. And the next day, we get a call from Tom Mount, one of Raimi's young lions, saying, "Repo Man, we want to revisit Repo Man." You know? And that was how it came about, supposedly. That's a story that Nesmith told me years later. But it has a certain ring of truth to it.
That's amazing. Had they said no before to that? Or?
Yes, they turned it down.
Yeah.
And so Nesmith was feeling quite despondent about the film because it didn't look like we were going to be able to get it on. I mean, he was looking to try and get $1 million or something to make it a super low budget in L.A. And that chance meeting with somebody who wanted to be his manager, you know, brought about this very... you know, fortuitous result.
Mm-hmm. I could see Nesmith actually championing that. He My wife will appreciate that. He did one of my wife's favorite films, which we'll never see Criterion, which was Tapeheads in the late 80s.
Oh, directed by Peter McCarthy. No, Peter McCarthy was the producer of Tapeheads. It was directed by Bill Fishman, wasn't it?
It was Fishman, yes. She's a big fan of that. I think it's only on DVD, but I could see that a cult label coming out with that. Of course, Repo Man is thought of as a cult film. We already mentioned Mueller, and I've mentioned I'm a big fan. Of course, Harry Dean, Emilio.
Well, the Harry Dean thing. I have to tell you the Harry Dean story because when I, after we cast Harry Dean, and he was clearly the best actor, for the part.
Mm-hmm.
When he came out, I went to his agent, who I think it was William Morris. It might have been CAA, one of the big agencies. And I went to his agent rather naively to sort of thank the agent and say, "I'm so pleased I'm going to be working with your client," And this guy goes, "You don't want to work with Harry Dean. Harry Dean's going nowhere. I represent some much better actors than Harry Dean. Why don't you put Mick Jagger in his part?"
Oh, that would be terrible.
Isn't that amazing?
And Harry Dean had, I think the same year, maybe the year after, had done Paris, Texas, too. And
he went immediately from Repo Man to Paris, Texas, because Wim Wenders didn't know him. And Robbie Mueller told them about this really good actor that was in, kind of crazy, but really good mm-hmm. actor that he was working with called Harry Dean. And Vin came out to Los Angeles early, met Harry Dean, and thought, well, this is the guy.
Yeah, I've heard he's nice. A little cantankerous.
Harry's very cantankerous. Harry must be 92 by now, so I don't think he's still as cantankerous, but he was very cantankerous.
Yeah, but I think he's a tremendous actor. Of course, we mentioned Hellman and Peckinpah, and he's been in a lot of those. I think it was
Coppola. He's done some.
That's right. He was in The Godfather, was it? Or I forget.
Let me think. Now, what's Harry? Because I know that.
Oh, he was in Apocalypse Now, wasn't it?
No, I don't think it's Apocalypse. Now, that's funny because I remember having this conversation with Harry about working for Coppola, and I'm drawing a blank as to what film it was that he was in. He was definitely in one of them.
We did our first actual podcast was about The Rose, which is we had audio problems. It'll never see the light of day, but he was in The Rose, and of course Bette Midler, he intimidated her so much, and I guess he was really mean to her. So, Mark, do you remember, was she crying or something? Or
yeah, I think afterwards it was pretty contentious scene there. Yeah.
Which actually worked in the context of the scene, I thought.
Yeah.
But
I think the thing is, there's a sort of I don't know if all actors who think of themselves as method are this way, but there is a sort of a tendency amongst actors to think that if I'm supposed to appear angry in this scene, I must become angry, and it isn't really so,
mm-hmm.
But and it does make for an uncomfortable environment if the actor actually really feels a need to get in a rage before playing an enraged character. It makes everybody on set very uncomfortable and anxious.
Mm-hmm.
So then hence that story about Laurence Olivier and Dustin Hoffman.
Oh, right.
Have you ever tried acting?
Marathon Man. I've heard that. You want to tell it?
Yeah, there's various versions of it, but one of the versions I heard was that Dustin Hoffman is going to, his character in the film is tortured by the mad Nazi doctor who pulls his tooth out mm-hmm. without anesthetic. And so Dustin said to Laurence Olivier, who was playing the mad Nazi doctor, I think I'm going to go to the dentist and have like some dental work without anesthetic so I'll know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm. Olivia said.
And Olivia just looks at him and goes, "Dear boy, haven't you ever tried acting?"
Olivier, that sounds like him. Of course, Olivier was definitely not a method actor.
I know
style,
another actor. Tremendous. I understand his work, and an actor friend in England who was in Revenge is Tragedy, who really does believe that one day, they'll invent a machine that we can read actors' minds in the movie. And so we'll see Marlon Brando, and Marlon Brando will be thinking, I hate you, I'm going to kill you, and we're going to see Laurence Olivier, and he's thinking, Laundry. What am I going to do that? Let me think. We'll be done by 4:30. I can get into the laundry before 5, I think.
I think that's Brando, I think.
Well, my friend thought the other way around. He thought it was that Brando was really feeling it, you know.
But well, early on.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? Because that machine hasn't been invented yet. So
that's true. It hasn't. It might someday. Or hologram of Marlon Brando. Tracy Walter. So, excuse me. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Tremendous. Yeah. So,
Still around. I saw Tracy about 5 years ago. And we were going to try and do something together, and the poor guy got in a car wreck, you know, and that was unfortunate. But other than that, he was doing great.
Mm-hmm. Well, Repo Man pretty much made your career, I guess you'd say, or would you?
Yeah,
say?
I think so. Repo Man and Sid and Nancy, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sid and Nancy as well. So, do you look at those with fondness? I know they're ancient history now, but do you watch them ever again, or are you pretty much moved on?
I don't watch my old stuff, you know, because because I just find fault with it, you know.
Whether
it's more interesting to see. I think anybody who like is in the creative business of any type, your most recent work is the work of which you are the most fond.
Uh-huh.
So whatever it is that you just finished, this is the best thing I've ever done. You always think that, you know.
Yeah, we're not creative, but we're not like that.
Okay. This was the best podcast we have ever recorded. Well, but you are creative. You're just, you know, you are creative. But everybody is creative, really.
This one might be.
Everyone
is creative. I mean, but what direction that creativity goes in, you know, what their aptitude, like I have no musical ability. I couldn't play an instrument or anything like that, you know. So it just, but I think everybody has a creative, substantial creative aspect to them.
I'm a drummer, so maybe I'll come work on the next Alex Cox film. I should mention that Repo Man is, and I don't know if you've ever gotten a hold of the Criterion release, but it's some of the best packaging.
It's lovely. Absolutely. The graphic, the cover graphic is just gorgeous.
And also,
it's the best poster design Repo Man ever had.
And there's also an insert, too, and I don't know if, I'm sure you have it, but there's a a little booklet. It's gorgeous.
There's a book. I did a cartoon in it, didn't I? Isn't my cartoon in there?
It is, yep.
It's some kind of cartoon history of Repo Man.
It's
off the shelf.
It's reprinted in there. Yep.
It's essentially, yeah. So the
Repo Code by Alex Cox.
The Repo Code, that's right. And that tells a story about me and Peter McCarthy and Jonathan Wax. Peter McCarthy, who was the producer of Tapeheads, and how it came about to make that film, and Nesmith, and the story of Nesmith in at Morton's.
Sorry, what were the artists that did that? Do you know, Mark?
Yeah, well, it was Jay Shaw and Tyler Stout, and it was designed by Rob Jones itself. So
yeah, it's gorgeous, you know, gorgeous. So those are the guys that did do Mondo, I believe, aren't they?
Yeah, I believe so.
They're just really talented. I mean, the cover graphic of the skull with the punk rock map of L.A.
It's beautiful.
Of his haircut, you know. I mean, it is beautiful.
Perfect. Yeah.
I love the design of the disc too, in that it's just, you know, it's white with a blue outline. And it just says disc on it, just like all the generic packaging. It's perfect.
Well, that's like the poster was, right? Wasn't it just Repo Man on the poster? The original poster?
No. Well, there might have been a poster made for a screening that was like that, but the original Universal poster was quite corny. You know, it was just a...
Okay.
It was like a Corman movie. Not that there's anything wrong with a Corman movie.
No, well, we know Corman.
I love Corman. I think Corman is a marvel.
Well, speaking of Monty Hellman, put together some great things, but I think he's more important for what he's done for others.
He gave everybody their start. Francis Coppola, Jack Nicholson, Monty, Scorsese, De Palma.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody worked for Corman.
But he had those 5-day production schedules, so some of his...
15 days max.
Yeah.
You know, you had to shoot your film in 15 days max.
And it had to sell, so... Well, we're already keeping you, I think, well beyond. Do you have a few more minutes?
It was very nice.
Can we? Do you mind if we get into Fear and Loathing and
no, of course.
Talk about that?
No. Yes, absolutely.
I know you wrote
what number is Fear and Loathing on the list?
Oh.
175.
175.
So you wrote this, and
I and my wife, Todd Davies, wrote an adaptation of Hunter Thompson's script, of Hunter Thompson's novel, when I was attached as the director.
Right. Speaking of cantankerous, Hunter S. Thompson. In fact, I think of him as guns and Texas. And in fact, probably today he would be the guys, one of the guys talking about gun control. Did you get to meet?
Hard to know, really. I mean, because he did seem to have lost it a bit.
Yeah, towards the end. Did you meet with him much, or?
Yes. In fact, if you wish to be entertained, somewhere on the internet there is a video. If you do a search, you can find a video of me and Todd going to visit Hunter S. Thompson in Woody Creek, Colorado, to talk about the script. And he had his own guys there, like the video crew, you know. And they're following us around, you know, shooting this video all the time, except when he gets the coke out. And when he gets the coke out, then they stop shooting. So for some reason, they have this deal going that they're not going to record Dr. Thompson doing hard drugs, you know. So he was like pretty messed up. I mean, he was quite drunk when we arrived.
Right. Yeah.
Television on with a football game. Had to watch the football game.
Huge into football.
Drinking more, doing coke and stuff. And we never talk about the script. You know, it's not like we're unduly naive, but nevertheless, you know, our time is worth something too. And you know, we're not courtiers, so we spent the day, you know, in his house with him getting drunker and sadder and more confused, and finally started talking about the script after it got dark. And he became fixated on a scene that we had written, which involved wedding. Going to sweep everything out to the sea and then come back in, and or something like that, some big apocalyptic image that he'd come up with, which is very good. And we thought that we should do it in the style of one of Ralph Steadman cartoons, you know, because they're so striking and so impressive, you know. And so we'd written that in the script in the style of one of Ralph Steadman's cartoons. We see the waves sweep across the desert, and he just kind of lost it. And was like freaking out that we thought he was a cartoon character. I go, no, we don't think you're a cartoon character.
Right.
You do, you put it here, you know. No, that's referring to Ralph Steadman's illustrations. Remember that? Let Steadman make his own movie. Okay. Yeah, and what I realized afterwards was that he had confused Steadman with Doonesbury.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's disappointing. So if you don't mind me asking, so what happened after that with, of course, Gilliam took over and finished the film, and...
Well, what happened after that was I had to cast the picture, and I had cast Benicio del Toro in the roles of Thompson and Dr. Gonzo. Deb, of course, although he was up for a reasonable salary, wanted more money than the production. And the producers realized that if they took the film to a studio, now that it had Johnny Depp on board, they could get a bigger budget. Universal. I'm not acceptable at Universal. So it's really Johnny's desire for more money turned into Terry Gilliam directing Fear and Loathing, because oddly enough, in spite of the Brazil farrago, Gilliam is an acceptable director at Universal, and I am not.
Oh, sure, yeah. I thought we were going to blame Rupert Murdoch again.
No, I don't think that we can blame Rupert. I wouldn't blame Rupert for anything, except for being an absolute son of a bitch and destroying democracy and raining death on so many people in foreign countries.
I think
he's a great guy.
Won't argue with you there. What do you think of Gilliam's treatment of Fear and Loathing? Do you think he captured your script and the material, or yours and your wife's?
I didn't see it.
Really? Okay. Still haven't?
No.
Okay.
Just, why would I watch it?
Just moved on? I don't blame you.
Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, you're still there. Good.
I wouldn't blame you for moving on. I guess I was going to ask you what you would have done differently, but I guess we have no idea.
What I would have done differently was that would have cast Ed Harris and Miguel Sandoval. They're much better actors. And
Ed Harris.
And they wouldn't have been as tedious.
Did you say Ed Harris and Del Toro?
Ed Harris as Dr. Thompson and Miguel Sandoval as Dr. Gonzo.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I don't know Sandoval as well, but yeah, I love
Sandoval.
Harris
plays like the bad guy in like drug lord movies, and he's the guy on the bus in Sid and Nancy who sings the "I Want a Job" song.
Okay. Yeah. And he's probably a face I would know at the
He's always on TV. He plays like the member of the Supreme Court, or he's the, like the head of the police on one of those like TV dramas. Well, so he's always around now.
For what
it's
worth,
he's a very, very good actor, and he was and in the old days he was like a really kind of radical Chicano. Mm-hmm. So he would have been into that aspect of the character.
Interesting. Yeah. No, I think that would have worked pretty well. So
and Ed Harris. I mean, you can see Ed Harris perfectly in the role of Raoul Duke. I mean, he's like the part he was made, born to play.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Good old John Glenn. But no, yeah. He's versatile. I mean, or Jackson Pollock. He's played a lot of iconic figures. Well, for what it's worth, and no offense to you, I did like Fear and Loathing. Maybe that's a testament to you since you wrote a lot of it.
I think we wrote most of it because we had to have an arbitration Writers Guild in order to get paid. In the end, I think that the writers decided that we did indeed write the script. So I guess that's the script that they made.
Well, I think our connection is fading in and out here. Tombstone Rashomon, and you, there's a Galactic Bill, the Searchers 2.0, which is not... Is it based... I mean, it doesn't sound like it's based on the Searchers, but it is.
It has got some reference to it. There's some reference. It's a story of revenge. It's a story of people taking revenge.
Okay, just not against Comanche Indians.
But don't go after the Comanche. They would be hard put to find many Comanche in Monument Valley.
All right, well...
Even the Ford could always do it.
Well, we'll keep up with you and keep in touch. And again, as I mentioned, people can...
Let me know. To give me some dosh. I'm pleased to accept contributions to the making of Tombstone Rashomon.
And we will call our Criterion bat phone and get Walker and Highway Patrolman made for you. And
Get them.
So, and... good luck with Tombstone, and I know the crowdfunding is...
Everybody's seen it, It's another one of those... Thank you very much for such a lovely chat.
Yes, it's terrific, and hopefully you have it again. Is there any place people can find you on the internet, or are you on Twitter?
Oh, if they were to do a web search for me, they would find my website very easily, I think. Not very hard to find.
And we'll put a link in the show notes, too.
Cool.
And we'll put one to...
The most recent stuff about... I mean, if there's two sites. There's a site called alexcox.com and there's a site called alexcoxfilms.com. And Alex Cox Films has got the more up-to-date stuff.
Okay. Yeah, we'll link to all those, and we'll link to Tombstone Rashomon. And, I can't wait to follow along this journey and stay updated. So
I'll keep you posted as to what happens next, and you don't have to read the script if you don't want to.
I'm going
to
read the script now. you sold me on the script. So, all right, Alex, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us. And
thank you very much. It was very nice talking to you.
All right, have a great day.
You too. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Welcome back, guys, and you are listening to Gang of Four. That's one that has not been in an Alex Cox movie, at least to my knowledge. Have you heard it?
Yeah, no, I haven't.
But he mentioned it in the interview, and I happen to be a Gang of Four fan. So when he mentioned that, I thought, yeah. And of course, I like a lot of the music in his films, and his films are very musical. That's why I think we have a lot of samples here. But this one seemed fitting because, it's about us, right? Right, Mark?
Yeah, exactly. Good stuff.
Well, I let off that part, so I'm going to kick it back to you here if you want to take us out of this thing.
Sure. We had a few things to mention, some of the links that we wanted to include based on the interview, and, of course, some corrections, some notes.
Hey, wasn't that awesome? Is it just me, or was that was Alex just amazing and tremendous?
Oh, he was great. He was incredible. Like I said, I loved how candid he was, and he was just great. It was funny. So it was awesome to talk to him. Really appreciate that, Alex.
And sometimes he surprised me. Rupert Murdoch, which actually became kind of a we came
a
back to that
theme.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And wow, Hunter S. Thompson, that was quite a story.
Yeah.
and Herzog. So yeah, we've been preparing for this for a while and kind of keeping our mouths shut. And we did a lot of research, and hopefully it shows. Some things actually I researched and I brought up on the show and got surprised by the answer still. So
right, yeah, it's funny. Funny how that works. So yeah, it was great. I just loved how he, would bring up some films that we'd heard of, some that we hadn't, and talking about Kinski and Herzog, that was fantastic.
Kinski and Herzog, yeah, that was one of the great moments of many.
Yeah.
So
method acting, and so
yeah,
that was great. So as as I mentioned, we will be including some links to the different sites. There is there's alexcox.com that he mentioned. That's really his older site's no longer maintained, but there's still some content there. And then alexcoxfilms.wordpress.com is his new site, and that's really where you'll see information like there is a for his current projects, including Tombstone Rashomon. So we'll definitely include links to that.
Yeah, and if people go to alexcox.com and they see that that it says this site is not being maintained, that's true. That's not the most recent. And by the way, you can get to the WordPress by alexcoxfilms.com. It's not just WordPress. But if you go to alexcox.com, there are still a lot of interesting articles about, some things about his films. So there's interesting stuff there. It's just not like a current blog. So whereas the new one is more of a current blog, and yeah, he talks about Tombstone, talks about Bill, and other things.
Yeah, so good stuff there. So you can find that in the notes. We'll also include a link to the Kurosawa video that he mentioned. Again, that's a 1999 video. It's a profile in history of Akira Kurosawa, directed and narrated by Alex Cox.
Yes, and actually, we're not just going to link to it. We're going to embed it in the page, so of the podcast page. So if you go to CriterionCloseUp.com and find this podcast or /podcast, you'll find it. You can actually watch it on the page. Well, I was going to say as you listen to the show, but that might not work out so well.
Right. Yeah.
But the whole video is there for as long as YouTube keeps it up. So hopefully, there's no rights holders going to intervene. But you said you watched some of it, right?
I did, yeah. It started out. It sounds great. I want to watch the whole thing. I think it's just under an hour, so I recommend folks check it out. As he said, there's some other folks in the video, like Francis Ford Coppola and others, so it's
and Bertolucci, too.
Bertolucci, yeah. Yep.
And I'm going to watch it, too. I think it's going to be of interest to our listeners, but I wonder if, with Bertolucci, if there's something with the name The Last Emperor and when it came out, there might be a connection there. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, good point. So good stuff there, the Kurosawa video. He also, when talking about Tombstone Rashomon, we'd inquired about being able to contribute. And so there, the
mail
Indiegogo
him a check.
Is, yeah.
For $25,000.
Indiegogo is done, but you can get an executive producer credit if you send him $25,000. So why not?
Yeah, he was being serious, but really, I mean, how are you going to just mail Alex a check? He was also being facetious too, but you still can contribute, and he noted that too. Every little bit helps, and we kind of thought about it after we recorded the interview. How do we compile these? Because I'm sure people will. Actually, Mark, you mentioned you want to contribute.
That's my
right?
plan. Yep.
So if you want to contribute to Tombstone Rashomon, well, we have a link in the show notes to the Indiegogo project. So just click there, and you can see the reward levels, see what the project's about. And, he mentioned the script. And since we've recorded, I've read more of the script, and it is very Alex Cox is a brilliant writer. So you can read some more. But just email us at feedback@CriterionCloseUp.com. And we'll pass along your information. Maybe just give us your email and maybe your reward level that you would want to contribute. And we'll get that to Alex and make sure you're accounted for. And if there's any doubts whether as to whether he's going to handle the money, I mean, I've been watching this process for a while, and he's, you know, I trust the man. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, it, like you said, they didn't meet the goal, but they still get going to make the movie. So
yeah,
yep. So some other items we just wanted to mention. So the there was a movie that he had brought up when we were talking about Tombstone Rashomon that was a little bit hard to hear. And it was actually the movie Doc. This is a 1971 film from director Frank Perry, and he'd mentioned, you know, Stacey Keach, Faye Dunaway, Harris Yulin, all the stars in that. And of course, it told from, I believe it's told from Doc Holliday's viewpoint. So
yeah, right,
we'll
yeah.
include a link to that on the show page.
Yeah, when he said it, I think it was the connection. I thought he said dark, and I thought
right.
dark. There have probably been
dark.
There have probably been movies named Dark. I mean, that's a pretty catchy title, but yeah, it's like, why would they name it? Of course, Doc makes a lot more sense.
Right.
So,
yeah.
No, I actually am enthused too. That's early Stacey Keach. You know, I could definitely see him in that role. So I think I'll see if that's available somewhere.
Yeah, that'll be cool. So that's we'll include a link to that. Also, when Alex was talking about the modern Mexican narco thrillers, we were a little bit out of our element.
You might pick up on Deer in the Headlights some.
not really too up on those, but that doesn't mean, you know, that we shouldn't be or check into them. So I remember you did bring up Amores Perros, Aaron, as a good one to check out.
Yeah, it's not exactly modern. I mean, that's what, 15 years ago, and actually, that's by Cuarón, isn't? Or is that Cuarón?
Yes.
Or
yeah, it's Cuarón.
Cuarón. Yeah. I mix up Iñárritu and Cuarón. We didn't mention Iñárritu on the show, but he's another one that started in Mexico and springboarded to Hollywood, and now he has an Oscar. So
yeah,
well done.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Another one I thought of was recent, but this really isn't a narco thriller, but it was a recent art film from Mexico, was Post Tenebra Lux, which was 2012, and it's you know, it's a very visual film. You know, I just what I remember from that screening is like lightning. When the lightning strikes, it's just it's just immersive visually.
Wow.
And there's, you know, it has the elements. You know, we talk about Kurosawa and how he uses elements. This is one that uses elements very well.
That's cool.
So there are good projects coming out of Mexico. Now, narco thrillers, I'm really not, still not aware of too much. So I'm curious if Alex, if you're going to listen, if you want to give us some specifics to check out, or if some listeners are aware of them, I'd like to hear about them.
Yeah, something we'd love to delve into. So.
And we did find that list. Well, actually, you found that list of 15 Mexican.
Yeah, 15 Mexican films to check out on Netflix. So just a recommendation there. So we can include that list. It says, 15 Mexican films you should stream on Netflix. So it does include some of the directors we had mentioned, like Cuarón and Iñárritu. And like you had mentioned, number one is the Carlos Regattas film, Post Tenebris Lux.
So, oh, right,
yeah,
right.
Good
right.
stuff there.
Which is well. Worth viewing. Of course, I looked at the list, and maybe a couple maybe would qualify as a narco thriller.
Right.
But yeah. Anyway, I'm curious about that genre too. I actually trust Cox's knowledge about movies. So if there's something there, I want to see it.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll include that link for folks. Another correction was with I'm Not Scared, Aaron.
Oh, that was me. I
were you scared?
I was just trying to come up with something, and I don't know what part of outer reaches of my brain that came from. I was thinking, okay, I remember this film from 10 years ago. Was that Mexican thriller? That was Italian.
Yeah.
Actually, that strengthens his argument that people can use different nationalities to pat that Americans yeah. can't tell the difference. The second the show ended, I was like, I'm Not Scared is not Mexican. It is a good movie, though. I do recommend it. And have you seen it?
I haven't yet. No.
It's 2004, 2005. So it's about a child. It's shot from his perspective. It's a really good film, but I think when it came out, it did get some buzz, but it's pretty much been under the radar since. I don't know if it's available.
Yeah. But. Well, it's I definitely want to check that out. And one that I actually have seen is The Godfather 2. So have you seen that one, Aaron? That's
another one very under the radar. Forgotten film.
we were trying to think of Harry Dean Stanton and something else that he had been in. And Alex mentioned Francis Ford Coppola, and you mentioned The Godfather. And it's I mistakenly said Apocalypse Now. It's not Apocalypse mm-hmm. Now. It's The Godfather 2. He played FBI man number one.
So. Harry Dean was flying the chopper. You just couldn't see him.
Must have been. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I just recalled Godfather. I didn't recall which one, but yeah, I'm glad to be half right, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, get some points there for sure. So
yeah,
and we also talked about Ralph Steadman a bit. So he did do the cover art for Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and he's also in the collection for. There's always different pronunciations here, but I've always called it Withnail and Eye. I know some people call it Withnall and
yeah, Withnall, yeah.
But that's the Bruce Robinson film. So he also did that.
That was quite a story, and actually it's kind of curious that ended up being the cover given the situation with Alex. And also that story does that does kind of reinvigorate his position as being independent because, once it came down to money, Alex was out and they got Terry Gilliam is an art director, but he does work within the confines of Hollywood and the studios, the Fisher King especially was his introduction to that. But yeah, not a good fit as a Hollywood film for Alex, I'd say.
Yeah. So that was Ralph Steadman. And really lastly, I think for the corrections and discussion afterwards is Miguel Sandoval, someone that we were trying to place. And of course, that's when Alex was talking about casting Fear and Loathing. He had mentioned Ed Harris and Miguel Sandoval. And of course, he was in, folks might know him from Jurassic Park. He's in the film very mm-hmm. early on when they find the amber. I'm sure folks have seen that. And he was also in Blow and Clear and Present Danger, some of the things he's known for. So folks, find him on IMDb. You'll definitely recognize him.
Yeah, once you see the face, you'll recognize him. And in fact, once I looked him up afterward, I'm like, oh, that guy.
Of course.
Yeah. He's done a ton of TV, which Alex actually mentioned. And I remember him from some TV shows. I don't remember specifically what.
Yeah, exactly. It's a face you don't forget for sure. Mm-hmm. So thanks everyone for listening. That was the Alex Cox interview. Really great stuff. We just wanted to close with, of course, as we always do, how to find us. And also, Aaron is on his quest for 2001 Twitter followers. So he's getting there, not quite there, but just a word of reminder, as soon as he does, he's going to do, what do we want to call it, the 2001 A Space Oxy?
Oxy,
there we go.
I'm having surgery now in just a few days, so I will be doing Oxy this week legally and necessarily, I should say. So yeah, we have had a joke that if I got 2001 followers, I would do around that time. I would do a podcast 2001 on Oxy, and now, of course, whether I can actually pull it off is up in the air. But we'll see. Mm-hmm. I don't want to overpromise, but if I'm up for it, we could even do a commentary.
Yep, but, exactly.
So yeah, I think right now I looked this morning and I was 30 followers away. So follow me, AWest505, if you want to get this Oxy. And if by the time I wake up and am coherent, if I have over 2001 followers, I'm gonna do it.
Perfect.
If not, I'm just gonna recover and forget about it.
Yes. Well, so. Best of luck to you this week, Aaron. I'm sure I speak for our listeners too. We wish you the best this week. So good
thank
luck.
You but I plan to be back next week. Now we're gonna plan to do a show, so
Aaron's a hardworking man, as people know, so we'll look forward to having you next week. Can't wait.
I might sound like this.
like you smoke, two packs of cigarettes in an hour. Very nice.
All right, I might become Redneck Aaron. Hey, y'all. Right?
I'm gonna just do that the whole show. Sure.
Talk about some Criterions now.
good stuff. Well, yeah, good luck, Aaron. We look forward to talking to you.
Thank you.
So, and if folks can find the show online, of course, we are at CriterionCloseUp.com/podcast. You can find the show on Twitter at CriterionCU for close-up, of course. And where can folks find you, Aaron?
I also should mention we can find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/CriterionCloseUp. And I should have given my Twitter address, AWest505, like those jeans that nobody wears anymore.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. You find us here. Again, a lot of listeners, I think people will like this show. We've said it a lot, but, you know, if you like this show and like us to want us to keep doing stuff like this, please leave us an iTunes review. We have other names that are on our radar, some that we've reached out to and talked to. I think we're going to have a lot of interesting shows like this in the future. So, yeah, we'd like to hear from you guys, hear what works, what doesn't. Leave us feedback, like us on Facebook, comment, tweet us. We'd love every last bit of that. So
yeah, we'll take it all in. And email, we have the email, feedback@CriterionCloseUp.com. So send feedback there. And, you know, again, if you're interested in contributing to Tombstone Rashomon, that's the email address to use.
Yes, and please support, forget us. For support right. Alex's project. That's for this episode, that's foremost. So we want to support Alex.
Exactly. And folks can find me, Mark Herney, at Mark Herney, H-U-R-N-E, on Twitter. And a letterbox the same place. So, next week, Aaron will be back. I should mention Aaron's going to be on Criterion Cast this week, too, to talk about 2015 Criterion releases.
I sure am. And, I was pleased to be invited by the folks. What's interesting is that actually I'm going to appear, we're going to record it the evening before my surgery. But I'm going to do it. I would not pass it up. And I've already got it worked out and everything. And I'm already prepping my favorites of the year. So, I recommend anybody that listens to this show listen to Criterion Cast anyway.
Yeah, but absolutely.
Especially listen to this cast. In fact, you guys are going to hear this show before I will.
That's right.
It might take me a few days.
No, that's great. We can't wait to listen to that. It's always a fun episode just to, talking about the year in review. So. Looking forward to it.
Me too.
And next week, finally, we'll be talking about our own. We're going to have Martin Kessler back on, another repeat guest. And we're going to talk about, it's a Criterion Close-Up episode, as we call it, where we don't do a film review, but we are going to talk about 2015 a bit and our favorite non-Criterion releases of the year. And that's, physical releases that we're going to get into. So
right,
look forward to that.
And you guys can chime in with your favorite Criterions, too, but we figured since I'm doing the Criterion Cast, it would be a little redundant to just do Criterions. I think it'll be a fun show, and hopefully I can talk.
Yes. If not, we'll just put you on Oxy and see how it goes, so look forward to that.
Might be a very interesting show. I'm my favorite title of the year might be Blue.
Right.
And I just mean the color blue. I don't mean a disc.
Oh, it sounds good. Well, that's a good good segue into. Thank you again for folks listening, and we're gonna have Mr. Sid Vicious lead us out. So, thanks again for listening, folks.
Hello? You there, Alex? Alex, you there?